Welcome to Automates, the podcast that brings you musings from thought leaders and industry pioneers who are shaping the way we work, think, and succeed. Each episode is packed with insights, expert interviews, and practical tips that will inspire and empower you to take your business to the next level. So tune in, subscribe, and get ready to innovate with Automates. Right. Hello, Andrew, and welcome to Automates. How are you, sir? You well?
I'm good, thank you. Very well. Enjoying the warmer weather here in Toronto, which has taken a long time in coming.
Don't you well. Basically, that's the same as here, because I'm in the last few days has been lovely, but actually today's been raining, yesterday raining. This is what happens in England, but you know that all too well. Cool. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Andrew. Who are you and where do you come from?
Who am I and where do I come from? Well, I am currently the CEO and founder of Datable. Prior to that, I accidentally fell into legal tech in 2004, which is dating myself. And I started with a company called Visual Files that you may remember. And so I was there when Visual Files was Visual Files. I was then there when it got acquired by Lexus. Okay. I was there when they acquired Axia as well. So lots of names from the past. And I had the pleasure of going on the, what did they call it? Content. What did Lexus call it? Content infused workflow, I think was their thing. Something like that. Anyway, So I did all the sort of Lexus stuff. So I did content, I did finance systems, case management. I was involved in Lexus One in the very early days, which again, you may remember.
Yeah.
Streamline, which was the supposed to be the future of Visual Files and failed. And then I moved to Canada, started selling iManage through a consultancy. Did that for 3 years, then got into CRM through one place. So was employee number 5 working with Tim Smith, and then worked with them through to the acquisition by Intapp. Went to Intapp, did some stuff, did intake conflicts time, all that kind of stuff, and then decided I'd have a crack at doing it myself. And here we are.
Nice. So you've been everywhere and done everything. That sounds wonderful.
I have literally touched every tier one system that a law firm would use in my career.
That sounds dangerous.
It does, doesn't it?
There's a couple of things. I love Tim. He's a good friend, but I've not spoken to him in a long time. But that must have been pretty cool, riding that sort of Salesforce-y kind of drive for a new flavor of CRM back in the day. So that's good. One of the things that sort of, you said 2004, I think I beat you in legal only just. So I haven't done as many jobs as you for as many different people, but I think I came into legal in 2002, something like that.
You go straight out of university into legal.
No, I'm older than that, young man. I'm older than that.
Hey, I was throwing you a bone. Come on.
It doesn't work. But you mentioned being the founder of Datable. So tell us about Datable. What does that do? Does it have anything to do with football, and does it have anything to do with data?
Surprisingly, it has nothing to do with football. If it had anything to do with any sport, it would be closer to baseball, because we stole some of the name from the film Moneyball, which I'm sure many of the audience have seen, which was a fantastic film. If you like that sort of thing. But yes, it is all about data. We describe ourselves currently as a revenue operations platform. So what does that really mean? I mean, ultimately, our goal in everything that we do is to embed data in how you generate revenue, right? And I think about that in two buckets. So there's what I would refer to as sort of operational quality. So how can you use data to inform things like discounting, work in progress, write-offs, all of those sorts of operational things that impact revenue. So if you think about a law firm, law firms have, and professional services more generally, there is a total amount of money that you can ever make, notwithstanding alternative fee structures and those sorts of things, that is a function of how many people you have that are billable, at what rate, and how long that they work, right? And if you look at law firms globally, they probably leak somewhere between 15 and maybe as much as 40% of that, depending on who they are and what they do, right? So there's this huge opportunity, and this is where I think you guys come in as well, this opportunity to start using data to say, okay, how do we reduce that leakage? With the huge explosion in AI, everyone's going, well, let's everything's a nail, let's hit it with a hammer. Well, what if we could put data behind how you think about where you use AI, where you use automation? And so that's part of what we think about. And then the other side of the revenue coin is what I would refer to as client quality. And so what we think about there is, where are you placing your chips from a client perspective? Are you growing the right clients? Are you investing in the right clients? Are you using your diverse staff in the right places? And ultimately, how do we maximize the revenue opportunity that we get from our clients, whilst also starting to influence the customer service side of things? And I think we all know that law firms, it's never been a factor. It's all about the revenue. But I think with the advent of AI, I think that is going to create another shift in the client experience. And the clients are going to expect more. They're going to want better service. And so I think, how do we start to put data behind that? And I think just my last point is also helping firms think about how they do that in a better way, leveraging technology. Now, that might not be our technology. That might be other people's technology. But let's start putting the right processes in place to make that customer success piece easier. And there's a whole cultural change piece around that as well. But anyway, yeah, that's kind of our thesis.
Wow. So, I mean, that sounds pretty impressive / ambitious. I mean, I always look at, we live in a similar, not the same world, but a similar world whereby sort of cultural change, adoption of new ways of thinking, okay, well, can workflow automation improve this for our team, our client? What does that mean? Can we do it more effectively? Is there increased productivity? Can we charge more for it? Do we need to charge less for it? All of those things come into play when we're talking about our software, but you're getting to the heart of it, which is really interesting. And how are you then, or who are you talking to inside of firms at the moment? Is it the marketing teams? Is it finance? Is it others?
So I think we start, just based on my background, we started with the chief marketing officers, chief business development officers. So thinking about that client quality aspect, right? We are now starting to talk to COOs who have that sort of holistic view across everything.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we will bring together the two components, because client quality really does sit with your CMOs and your CBDOs, right? But then the COOs have that overarching perspective. I think ultimately, yes, we will start to speak to the CFOs as well. But I think it's going to be an iterative process.
Yeah. And so when you were talking about the data, and what data are you tapping into? Is it practice data? Is it billings? What are you looking at to then been able to sort of drive the insights and change that you're looking to achieve?
Yeah, it's a good question. I like to describe ourselves as data junkies. So the more that we can get, the more that we can do. And you know, that is really the power of what we're doing, is building a platform that allows us to help users consume data, right? That's our mission statement. How do we make it easier for users to consume data in delivering whatever it is that they do? So if I'm a BD person, a marketing person, a partner in a law firm, right, serving that up in a way that makes it easy for them. And so the more data that we can get a handle on, the more insights that we can provide, but the more directional accuracy we can deliver as well, right? And so we look at all of the internal stack, as long as firms will give it to us, right? So everything from HR data to time and billing data, CRM experience, website tracking, e-marketing, event data, all of those things we try and piece together. We haven't got to document management yet, but I think there's a huge opportunity in the DMS, and I think the DMS providers are doing some really cool stuff with large language models that's giving you more structured data, right? One of the things that we know about DMS is that, you know, check-in narratives were rubbish and tagging of documents, all that kind of stuff just hasn't been good. And so I think large language is presenting an opportunity to turn that data into something really powerful. And so I think that's something that we will start to look at. But then we also look at external data, right? So we think about things like PitchBook. What can we learn in the context of M&A? We think about news. Can we look for indicators that would suggest that Peloton is probably looking for restructuring support, right? As a sort of very topical example. And then other sources. So, you know, here in the US, of course, we can get to docketing information. So we can see case filings. We can see patent filings that you can do sort of, you know, globally. But those are really interesting data sets where we can start to serve up indications of, you know, interest. So if you think about maximizing your client, one of the things that general counsel says, and this is funny, actually, someone wrote a summary of a general counsel panel that they sat on recently here in Canada. And the three or four takeaways were exactly the same three or four takeaways that I have seen in every single panel I have sat in for the last 10 years. Nothing's changed. Law firms continue not to deliver what the GCs are asking for. One of the big things that they keep asking for is how can you be more proactive, right? And so the use of external data combined with internal data allows us to start systematizing some of that proactiveness that the GCs are looking for. Mm. And I think we all know this, right? It isn't necessarily the fault of the partners. We know that there are good partners out there who are rainmakers who just do this stuff naturally. But 95% of partners in law firms don't necessarily know how to do this. This isn't what they were trained to do. They haven't spent two decades being a salesperson like me. And these are things that you learn and you evolve into, right? Yeah.
I guess, do you see, and I think we've both been around it. I mean, I worked for a firm for 10 or so years, and I've been on the other side of the fence for the best part of the next 15 or whatever. But do you see, with the rise of the focus on data through the introduction of Gen AI and all of that sort of stuff, do you see the traditional law firm model evolving? Part of my thinking is that actually there's got to come a time where, as you said, for the last 10 years, nothing's changed. I'm sure some things have changed, but broad brushstrokes, nothing's changed. What's going to be the trigger point to force it? Now, obviously, clients have been a big voice back in my day at HiQ, where we were delivering portals of information, transaction management solutions, and everything else. It would be at the behest of a client. Clients would have access and they would sort of be driving what they saw, when they saw it, how they interact with it, and how that sort of evolves. But ultimately, it's not necessarily changed too many of the behaviors. You talked about something just then. So partners aren't trained to be salespeople. And do you see sort of the introduction / rise of the salesperson being more formalized inside of law firms, for example? Is that something that you can imagine happening? I mean, I'm pretty certain I've seen perhaps some of the more tech-enabled or ALSP kind of advanced sort of view of the world over here in the UK hiring salespeople. But do you think that sort of treads on the BD toes, because BD is sort of sales, but it's not sales, if that makes sense. So how do you see that evolving? What do you see as the trigger for the next thing that's going to enable firms to adapt?
It's really interesting. I mean, the UK has some really interesting examples, right? You look at firms like Setford's and Knight's would be another good one, right? Where they have taken advantage of the changes in legislation. They are now businesses and their lawyers are consultants, and they don't worry about finding business necessarily. I think those two firms have slightly different models, but for the most part, those types of organizations are putting structured sales organizations around their lawyers, and they are the people that go out and find the work. And there's, marketing campaigns and all that kind of stuff, but it's much more of a traditional services business in the way that you and I would think about, technology services, right? We have a bunch of people who are experts at Power BI or whatever it is, right? Implementing document management systems. And we don't expect them to go sell. Equally, as a software company, I don't expect my engineer to go sell. Now, it just so happens that he's pretty good in front of clients, but that's not always the case, right? And so, I think the UK is developing some really interesting models that will be successful. One of the interesting stories from the pandemic, though, was an Am Law 50 firm who had set up a traditional sales environment. They didn't generate all of the business, but they were salespeople who carried quota and were out in market generating new matters. And they had support from the partners, obviously, but they were true salespeople. The team was very successful, overachieving on targets, delivering revenue. Pandemic hit, people got twitchy. Partners canned the whole team. And it was a great example of, and I described this to somebody the other day in the context of change management, my experience, and this isn't all of them, but partners in law firms are like elastic bands. You stretch them and they go, oh, this is great. And then the world changes and they go back to where they were. And it has happened for decades. And I remember it even in my days as Visual Files when I was starting out. We were convincing people to use technology to automate things like a completion statement, right? So put all the numbers in and get the system to do it for you. And you would go and talk to partners and say, look, you can do this in a second. They'd say, yeah, but I always do it this way. Why? What value are you adding to the completion statement? It's just calculations. Yeah, but then, this is my secret sauce. This is my expertise, right? And so, to answer your question, yes, I think we are seeing a rise in salespeople. I think we are seeing a rise in partners changing and adopting technology through large language models. I believe, and I don't know that everyone agree with this, but I believe it is out of fear. Because I think they believe that if they can get ahead of large language, then their clients won't, because they recognize that it is a risk to them in the context of billings, right? And so, I think we will see a rise in salespeople. I was talking to someone the other day. I believe that law firms should have a chief commercial officer who is responsible for revenue. All of it, right? How do we make revenue? How do we maximize revenue? And have one person who is looking at all the different parameters that affect revenue and saying, this is what we should do. Because think about, there are so many examples that you can give in the context of revenue, right? You have, we continue to try and do work with such and such blue chip company. Why? Their revenue hasn't grown in 5 years. Profitability, not that great. Do they pay on time? Probably not. Why are they a client? Because it conflicts us out of somebody else who potentially we could generate more revenue from. But because that revenue question sits at a partner, an individual partner, and then you've got BD and marketing who are trying to influence more broadly, you're actually not necessarily making good business decisions, right? Because you're not actually running as a business.
Yeah.
And so I think there is an opportunity. And I think one of the things that I'm seeing is that coming, but bringing it back to data, you've got CMOs and CBDOs who are using data to elevate themselves and the things that they're doing with data to elevate themselves in the firm, get themselves a seat at the table. And I think once they get a seat at the table in a much bigger way, right, I think that will potentially grow the potential, right, for more sales orientated people.
Makes sense. I mean, it's one of those things when you look at it and you go through the lack of change and the opportunity that's out there. And I mean, you just mentioned one thing, sort of, we've got a client, it conflicts us out of two other clients, but they're doing much better in the industry, they're generating more revenue, they've got potentially more pipeline for us, but we're going to give that to somebody else because we like this business. It does make you, it does bring you back to that sort of one of the things. You've got bad fit clients, you've got good fit clients, you've got your classic sales kind of questions around what's your ideal customer profile, what does it look like? Now, of course, from a law firm perspective, that's going to vary from practice to practice and everything else. But as sales professionals, and I'm not really a sales professional, but I dabble almost. We build out personas of people that we want to talk to. We build out personas of our ideal customers. We start to create these profiles of things so that we're talking about the stuff that they're interested in, so that we can then drive the right kind of pipeline to do the right thing, to make our sales cycle shorter, to make it easier to implement. It impacts all aspects of the business. It really does. And I think they're the kind of nuanced tidbits almost, and then they're more important than that, but you know what I mean, these little aspects where independently they're just one point, but actually as a collection, the more professional sort of structure you get around it, it definitely makes sense. I do think there's an interesting sort of just a difference between sort of the US and the UK though, in terms of how that approaches. I don't have any data to hand or any sort of examples, but it does feel easier over this side of the water to potentially be in that spot. And I think you talked about LLMs, and it doesn't have to be just LLMs, but the whole, anything that's, any practice where it's tech enabled, where you've got a real focus on delivering solutions. I know the Linklater spin-off CreateIQ, that's focused on running itself as a little business unit and sort of driving revenue. I remember looking at the AO Sphere that a good friend of mine, Marc Henry, used to run, and that they generated business product out of technology using lawyers' brains and expertise, but they ran a massively successful ARR business. And it was just as a little sideline. It started as a little sideline. And it's like you start to look at these things, and it's, but it is tech that seems to be driving, whereas probably 5-6 years ago, you'd argue, yeah, clients are driving the change, I think whether it's in fear or not, with regards to large language models, whether it's trying to push in through, I do think that technology is having an increased influence over strategic direction these days. And I think that's good and bad. I think I've got good friends who work inside of law firms, and that's some I talk to, and they're really cautious around Gen AI and what's happening, and the fact that every vendor under the sun's got a magic button that does something to do with Gen AI. And how that sort of sits and operates and what that does. But you've got others that have gone knee deep, and they are welcoming it, and they're bringing it on because they want to be seen as at the forefront of what they do and how they do it. Whether that's protectionism, as you say, or out of fear, or because they've seen the opportunity, time will tell. But it will be an interesting evolution. I'm going to flip slightly and go back to something that you said. So you Datable, you tap into and have connectors or access into lots of different technologies. The rise of sort of that whole integration and ecosystem, I think, is understated. I think there's lots of things that sort of go out and you sort of go, oh, somebody's just released a press release because they've got iManage integration, or they've got this, or they, and naturally, yeah, you want to talk about these things, and that's how you sort of present it. I know we can't build everything, so we have to partner with people, and we do partner with people. We partner with technology providers, implementation people, we partner with resellers, etc., etc. But the idea that we focus in on the strength of that ecosystem to provide a firm, law firm or otherwise, a service, because ultimately we can't do everything. How's that evolved over your years of 20 odd years of working at 17 different vendors and doing everything else? What does that look like for you these days, particularly where you're interested in the underlying data that those systems of record either hold or transporting or whatever?
Yeah, it's interesting. If I think back to the visual files days, right, where everything was on premise, and you know, we were in those days, we were connecting with the finance system, obviously. We were integrating with document management, right? So that if people had iManage, they could embed that into the case management system. We sort of integrated with Interaction, but nobody really knew why. And so, you know, it was all point to point, on premise type stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, we now live in a world where, yeah, there's still on premise, but increasingly most of the stuff is going to the cloud, which, you know, as a founder of a startup, that's a whole nother conversation of the challenges for a startup person, right? And we can talk about that too. But I think that when I talk to firms, my number one recommendation to them is that they build some sort of data repository. Call it a data lake house, swamp, pond, whatever you want to call it, whichever type of technology, right? But start bringing all of your data together in a unified data set, because ultimately, if you think, particularly when you think about the business of law, right? Practice of law, that's a different piece. But if you think about the business of law, most of the problems that we're trying to solve are a function of two things: data and user engagement, right? And so, you know, when I talk to people, I'm saying, look, bring it all together. Stop doing these point integrations. Now, there are certain situations where you have to do a point integration, right? Yeah. So if you want to serve up documents from iManage inside a process, of course you have to do a direct integration, right? But if you want to use a piece of data from the finance system, let's stop going to the finance system directly as a point integration. Let's pull all of that into a nicely connected data set that we can just draw from. Connect to that data set once, which increasingly is you know, easier, right? I mean, you can do it with SQL connections, obviously, but you know, you look at things like Snowflake, you look at things like Databricks, they all have APIs, right, where you can now get in and you can get the data that you need. And actually, that, you know, one of the benefits for us as Datable is that we are able to build our platform in a way that if somebody has a data lake, we can just connect to their data lake. And from a you know, a data residency perspective, yes, we process the data, but the data, we don't store the data, stays in their data lake, and you know, and that's where it stays. So you know, I think increasingly firms are starting to think about that, right? Because what they're observing is you go buy a CRM system and then you buy an experience system, as two examples, you now have to connect them to these multiple systems twice. Well, why would we do that? That doesn't make any sense. But I think what's interesting is that as people start to think in that way, it starts to open Pandora's box a little bit, because once I've got all of the data, if I stop thinking about building data lakes constrained by applications, CRM and experience as two examples, right? Now I think about, well, what's the problem I'm trying to solve? Because I'm, you know, everybody recognizes now, for the most part, that partners aren't going to look at CRM, right, as an example. So what am I, I'm going to buy a CRM system, what am I going to use it for? Well, I'm going to use it to manage lists and run events and track opportunities in the BD team. Okay, so do I need to go buy a legal CRM, or could I buy HubSpot? Well, if you're a small firm, go buy HubSpot. Why not? There's a bunch of great stuff, right? So I think we're in this. We're in a really interesting spot, and I think both you and I have lived this vision of one day we will get to a point where things get really interesting, and we're going to hold on until that point. And we're not going to leave legal and go and make a ton of money in corporate. We're going to stick around because there's something coming, right? And I think we're here. I really feel like we're here for a whole variety of reasons. Yeah. And I think everyone's focused on large language models, but there's other stuff going on that's really interesting too.
Yeah, no, 100%. But I think it goes to the need to become more data savvy, which is ultimately more technical. You do need to become a bit more technical, and you do need teams that understand data, relational data models, what that looks like. I know we both know Tom Baldwin from Integrata. He's set up a business to help firms do exactly that. And so it's really interesting. I mean, I think the rise of data and the connectivity between technologies is really interesting. It is the reason why we're not making a ton of money in corporates, probably.
Well, I think
my little deck chair business on the Isle of Wight is probably my next path. You know what I mean? But you know, that's just the way things. That's the limit of my capabilities, I think. You mentioned sort of the challenges surrounding startups and opportunities, and it's something that I've talked previously on this podcast with a couple of people about, and sort of. People in general, having an idea is for some people the easy bit, but actually 9 months in and you're now 9 months in, you've got the idea, you've got some traction, you understand what your ideal customer profile looks like, the personas that you're talking to, you've got all of that sort of banged on because you know you're a sales professional. So that's what you do with an idea around something that's going to be interesting. But I think it's really interesting having joined HiQ 10 years after it started, but just as it was picking up. So going through probably a scale-up phase rather than a startup phase, and coming to Autologix, where actually the timeline is about the same. It's about 10 years, but ultimately we're a little bit behind where HiQ was when I joined it. But ultimately it's sort of the opportunity is exciting, but really challenging. And I think that there's a whole bunch of stuff some people do talk about. I mean, I don't know if there are many podcasts that talk about the challenges of setting up your own startup and going off and doing that. I don't know. Is there two or three tips other than don't do it? Because that would be boring. But what are your two or three tips that you could throw out just to close off the conversation to people that have just started, that they're just going through some of the things that you and I may be going through, but have gone through in the past? What does that look like? I've thrown you a bit of a curveball right at the end. Gone off piece. But I think it's good for the community to sort of hear these kind of real world scenarios. Not everything is Series A funding after 3 months and look at us, we've got a ton of money that we can go and spend. That does happen, but it's not always that. It doesn't always work out that way. You know what I mean? And sometimes you don't want it to work out that way. Sometimes you want to sort of see your little baby grow naturally and sort of push it on. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? And as a founder, it can be you can become disillusioned, right? When you see things like the Harvey announcements and, you know, the sort of acquisitions that happen for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and you know, but it is. I remind myself regularly that the majority of investment that you see will naturally be in the practice of law, because that is something that the investors understand, right? So if I go and talk to an investor about the inner workings of a law firm, they have no idea. And what's funny was I was talking to a guy last week who used to be the head of a legal department for a, you know, top 50 blue chip company. And we were talking about pitching and relationship management and, you know, customer success and satisfaction and all that kind of stuff. And there are a couple of things that we talked about. And at the end of the call, he said to me, "I now understand why I had the experiences that I had in dealing with law firms." And he had no perspective on what goes on inside a law firm, right? And so as somebody who is building a platform that is really focused on business of law, it is challenging to go and get investment because the people that you're asking for investment from don't really understand it. So a lot of the advice that I've been given is find somebody who gets it, right, to lead you around, and then go find and then go talk to the other people, because now you have somebody who understands it, who's putting their weight behind it,
yeah.
And that will help you go and get the other funding. But it can be frustrating because you look at all of this money that's getting thrown at people like Harvey, which, I mean, I don't think anybody really understands what Harvey does at this moment in time. But, you know, it's great and wonderful, apparently, and they've got a whole ton of money. And so, you know, that can be challenging. I think one of the other things, and sort of in conjunction with that, one of the other big challenges that you face is the move to the cloud. So I remember talking to the founder of Visual Files, and the original product was called Soulcase. And he talked about the days, so this was Neil Ewan, and he talked about the days when, you know, he'd rock up with a computer in the back of his car, and he'd roll into a meeting and he'd plug it all in, and then he'd sit there and he'd do a demonstration on a PC of Soulcase, which was managing conveyancing matters. And all he had to be able to do was code and put it on a disk, right? And then help somebody set up the server and plug the disk in, and away you go. As a founder now, you can't just write code. You have to build a whole infrastructure of security that is wildly expensive to even get through the door, right? So, you know, I have to be able to go into firms and say, I'm on the SOC 2 journey, right? Or I'm on the SOC 2 journey, and then I'm going on the ISO 27001 journey, and, right? And all of these, and all these things. And that's just getting worse because GDPR, CASEL in Canada, Californian regulations, federal regulations in the US. Now you've got the AI regulations in Europe. You've got the AI regulations that are going to exist in the other jurisdictions. All these things, coupled with the weekly announcements at the moment of law firms that are being hacked, means that there is a certain amount of money that you have to throw at security just to get through the door, right?
Yeah, 100%. I can talk to that. That is one of those things that you sort of, we're 2 years into, or post ISO 27001, we started the project long before I joined Autologix. I wasn't the reason we finished it, but ultimately we did. And yeah, we're now on our SOC 2 journey. We're now talking about what we do after that. There's STAR accreditation. There's all of these things that ultimately, to operate in a cloud first, which means global, whether you are global or not, it means you can sell anywhere, is tricky because you're sort of juggling expectations around things that sort of is there. And it's not just your infrastructure and hosting. I mean, we're AWS, so we get a lot of, we piggyback off a lot of native Amazon toolkits and things that you buy as additional services. But ultimately, there might be a cheaper way of doing it. But, you know, it's like, it's the easiest, least path of resistance. It does the job that it says it's going to do. We, in its crudest form, which sounds terrible, ticks a box to make sure that we are doing the thing that our clients or prospective clients want us to do. We're doing it for the benefit of ourselves. I think ISO was a really good eye-opener for us as a business. We were actually doing most of the things anyway, but actually just making sure we were and knowing that we are and the process that you go that wraps around it was really eye-opening, I think. But yeah, so it's, I think the security is a big one. And I talk to, it's probably one of the biggest things that I talk to other startup founders about. It's the thing that means that you can go and play with the big boys. You can go and do the things because it's almost like your little golden ticket. You've opened a chocolate bar and you've gone, oh, I can now go play in this little thing and watch Augustus Gloop get fat, which is a weird analogy, but it's just the way it is. That's the way my brain works. I think the other side of I was going to ask, I did ask for three, but you've given me two, so that's fine. So I'm going to give you a third and ask you to comment. When you're, I mean, you guys, Datable are smaller than us and we're a small organization. We've got some people who have actual job roles and responsibilities for doing specific things like security and legal and other bits and pieces. Whereas you have people like me that's got a very broad job title and I probably do 17 different jobs. How do you motivate yourself and prioritize the things that you need to do to drive your business forward on a daily basis? And I think it's a bit of a bullshit question because ultimately you just do what you've got to get done. But how do you take a step back and go, right, this is the plan? I've seen people have specific models. I've had people that swear by getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and getting shit done before the kids get up. What's your go-to hack for getting shit done?
Wow. it's a really interesting question that I think I can honestly say I'm still figuring out. So one of the things about me, just to digress slightly, so we recently went through an exercise with our daughter where we had her assessed for a bunch of stuff, and one of the things was ADHD. And so we went through the exercise and we, you know, she did all the testing and all that kind of stuff, and we're sitting down with the psych, and she's going through the report. She's saying all these things, and I'm looking at her and actually verbalizing. I'm saying, "This, what are you talking about? This isn't ADHD. This is just regular stuff. I do this all day long." So she gives me the look. I'm like, "Oh, well, that's interesting." So, you know, so in conjunction with starting a business, I've also been learning a lot about myself personally, and how my brain works, and so. I say that to say that in the context of your question, one of the challenges that I have is that someone used this phrase with me recently, which was really fascinating, high bandwidth conversations, thinking, whatever, right? I find that I high bandwidth and then crash and high bandwidth and crash because it's just mentally straining and tiring, right? And when you're starting a company, you're doing a lot of that. So a lot of the meetings that you're having is all about brainstorming and getting people excited about vision and all those sorts of things, right? And so one of the things that I have learned over the last sort of couple of weeks for me is when you're high, sounds bad, to get stuck in, right?
Yeah.
So, and to recognize that that might be really awkward for the family, because it might be Sunday afternoon or it might be Saturday lunchtime, but you are good to go. And that's the moment where you need to go.
Yeah.
And sort of, I think, knowing enough about yourself to figure those things out, right? And then I think you're right, in terms of, you know, the sort of prioritization of tasks, it's what do I need to do at this moment in time? So a lot of the last sort of 4 months has been me finding time to educate myself on security, right? So I have had to learn about SOC 2 and ISO and be in a position to sit in front of a CISO and answer intelligently questions about how we think about access to data and storage and, you know, risk assessment policies and all that sort of stuff that I've never had to think about before.
You have to become experts in stuff, 100%.
You do. You do. And, you know, to your point about AWS, when we were selling One Place, you know, it was on Salesforce. I was like, well, sorry, are you telling me, Mr. or Mrs. Law Firm, that you spend more on security than Salesforce? I don't think so. So it was a really simple conversation, right? Now, you're a small business, and yes, we use Azure, so, you know, the same as you, we get to benefit from a lot of their stuff. But one of the things that I have learned is that the number one problem in security is people. And every single dollar, for the most part, that you spend on security is about protecting or stopping people from being morons. And so, you know, you're right. You're learning new skills. I've got to do the accounting. I've got to send the invoices. I've got to chase the invoices. I've got to find new clients. I've got to think about product strategy. I've got to think about marketing and website and all this stuff. And you're just sort of constantly juggling. But one of the things that I find, just the way that my brain works, is that I can do little bits.
Yeah.
And so I'll do a little bit over here, then I'll do a little bit over here, then I'll do a little bit over there, and I'll keep sort of circling around through all of those things, and they just sort of iteratively rise up over time. That doesn't work for everybody. Some people need to do one thing and finish it and then move on to the next thing. And I think that's the important thing as a founder. You have to know yourself well enough to figure out how you just get through the stuff, because you've got to get through it, otherwise you sink. So,
100%. And you said stuff, not the word I said. So you get an extra clap at the end. Congratulations. That's really insightful, and thanks for sharing that, because I think it's oftentimes sort of burnout. Sort of in our industry, not just the software industry, but within legal, is very prevalent from a lawyer's perspective. But also, I hear of founders just crashing, literally just crashing. And it's one of those things that is good to talk about, good to share. And I think your point, there are different people out there that do things in different ways, but I'm very similar to you. I do lots of little bits and get things done, and I think that's a great way of it's a great way for me to approach things. Bud, thank you very much for your time. I won't take up any more of it, other than to say thank you, but also to say, when will I see you in person next? I'm not coming to Toronto anytime soon. So it has to be somewhere else.
Well, so hopefully I will see you at ILTA in Nashville.
Awesome.
Which actually is, I think, where we first met.
I do have some vague recollections of meeting you at an ILTA at some point.
I think that's where we first met. So yeah, hopefully going to go to ILTA, and then it's an interesting one. I'm going to ask you a question. What are some of the events? There's so many events now. How do you pick the events that you go to, and which are the ones that you like most right now?
There are almost too many. For a vendor that gets charged anywhere from silly numbers of thousands of pounds for sponsorship, or silly numbers of smaller numbers of thousands of pounds just to attend. There's a whole chunk of stuff that I think the events that I like are twofold. First, where there is a real strong community. So
yeah.
Legal Geek here in the UK. I love what Jimmy's done with the event and his increasing number of events. So he's got Legal Geek Growth in June, the main Legal Geek in the UK in October. And then there's a Chicago one. I don't know when that is, June or July. So Jimmy's done a really good job, and it is about community. There's education and knowledge and information and sort of vendors and all the stuff that you get of events. But I think Legal Geek is a top one for me. And I think that ILTA is always going to be a mainstay. I loved attending LMA back in the day when I worked at HiQ on the product that sort of was much more marketing focused. LMA again, because it was the people were great, you know what I mean? And sort of there was a community environment surrounding it. I think an event that is like education and vendors and stuff like that, I have less affinity to, because mm-hmm. I know that's not how people buy. So and this might sort of put me on somebody's bad books or people's bad books, but it's the event exists for vendors to get access to people, but the main event exists because there's good content, and you know the good content rises up above that, but actually the vendors are paying for that sort of the event to sort of exist. And I think that for me is why it's sort of when it's really obvious that that's happening, that's not my cup of tea. I do attend those events and I do pay to go to those events, but I'm much more sort of focused in on people, community, and the structure. And I don't know enough about the US, North America kind of events structure to comment really on what happens.
It's really interesting because I think, you know, the UK is slightly different, right? So I think about this post-pandemic. So one of the things that I find is that yes, people are in the office 2 or 3 days a week, right? But typically they are saving their internal meetings for the time when they're in the office, and they do a lot of their vendor meets remote, right? They don't need to be in the office to meet a vendor. We can do it on Zoom or Teams or whatever, and that works really well. And so I have found, certainly here in North America, that the events become more important for the FaceTime element of selling, right?
100%.
And so I'm on the advisory committee for LMA National for 2025. And one of the things that I said is, how do we create an environment where people can actually network? And yeah, you have the drinks event in the evening and you have the coffee in the vendor hall and that kind of stuff, but it's quite forced to a certain extent, and yeah, people just sort of, you know, glide around and I think as a vendor, yes, I want to go and consume the content, but for me now it is more important to have time to actually connect with people. And I find also that some of the people attending the event, they kind of need the event and its content to get internal sign off. But a lot of times I'm like, what events are you, you know, which sessions are you going to? Well, I'm connecting with this person and that person and this person, because they want to learn and benefit, to your point about community, from yeah, what other people are doing. And yeah, the sessions are good for that. I find, this is going to get me in trouble, too often the sessions are sales pitches masquerading as thought leadership. Don't care. Stop pitching your product. Tell me something interesting.
Ouch.
And so, and I think, you know, and I think the punters are wising up to that, right? It's like, yeah, but they need it.
Yeah, we talk internally about sort of marketing spend and what we should do, how we should do it, and I think post-pandemic and the rise of AI, I mean, the amount of emails I get that have clearly been written by a shit robot selling all sorts of stuff, going, hello, Mr. Ben, would you like And it's long gone are the days where somebody's bought a list. It's not. It's an actual robot that's sending you this stupid stuff. But I think, as you said, people are wising up. People don't want to engage with that stuff. I delete almost every bit of stuff that sort of even smells like a sales thing. Just go straight in. Yeah. I don't even look at it. It might be the best thing since sliced bread, but I've just got this natural aversion to that kind of content and that kind of, I'd much rather be tapped on the shoulder at an event going, oh, so I hear you do this. Can, are you interested in buying this? And it's like, well, maybe not now, but now that there's that human face-to-face kind of thing, I sort of always say that people buy from people. And so people don't buy from machines that hide behind email addresses that don't even exist.
Well, it's funny you say that. So I am terrible at networking. I hate networking. But I have something that works, right? And so I build my network, and I'll be at an event, and I will go and join people that I know who are with other people that I don't know. Yeah. And I use those people that I know's experience of me to get the introduction, right? To have a conversation. Oh, what do you do? Oh, I do this, this, and this. What do you do, right? And then you exchange the business cards. And there were some people who are really good at just walking up to, you know, people at the bar and saying, hey, why are you here? And starting a conversation. That's not me. And again, it comes back to you have to know yourself.
I'm far too British for that sort of.
Right. And so, you know, I think that personal touch is important. It's funny. I get hundreds of these, and there's a sales trainer here in the US called Sam McKenna, who you may have come across, actually.
Yeah, I met him a couple of times.
Right. So Sam has this idea of show me that you know me. And she has I think it's a one-page PDF or it's a two-page PDF that I now have saved on my phone. And when I get those really crap emails, I just send it to them. So I just reply and I attach the one pager on how to write a decent email. Because I get people emailing me saying, oh, you know, would you like to buy a list of manufacturing companies? No. Go look at my LinkedIn for 5 seconds and you'd figure out that I'm not interested, right? So I think it is, you know, and I actually started my career, I don't know if you know this, on the phone. So I was part of a startup where we were doing cold calling for enterprise software. So people like SaaS and SAP and all those types of people. And you had to get through the gatekeepers, first of all, and then you had to keep somebody on the phone long enough to have a conversation to hopefully get a meeting. And we would make 60 calls a day. We'd speak to maybe 5 decision makers, maybe 6, and we'd be expected to get 6 appointments a month. Mm-hmm. And you had to learn.
That's demoralizing. That's like the failure rate is so high. That's why email's so easy, but it's so shit because it just sort of, it's literally, I can send a million of these in like 2 seconds, easy, job done. But actually the crafting of it is the important bit and not being a robot.
Well, and I think there's a good balance, right? There's a good balance between, as long as your intention is to say, I want to write an email and I want it to be specific to this person. Now, again, I'm dyslexic, so I'm terrible at writing. And so one of the powers of AI for me is that I can use it based on my knowledge and what I want to communicate to create something that's actually readable and someone's going to want to engage with, right? Because if, you know, my natural scrawl, no one's going to want to read that. But it is that balance, right? It's use the technology to empower you to communicate in that case. Yeah. And show me that you know me is that Sam's pitch, which I think is great, right? How do you be as relevant and interesting as possible?
Makes it 100% sense. Mate, again, I sort of wrapped this up about 20 minutes ago, but then we carried on talking. Massively appreciated. Thanks for all your hints and tips and all the bits and pieces. Great to hear that Datable's going well. I'll see you at ILTA, no doubt, if not before.
Looking forward to it.